Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or The Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Smart daters, welcome to the podcast. For those of you that are new, welcome. For those of you that are coming back, I am so glad to have you because today is going to be an amazing episode because my good friend, Kate Anthony, is here with us. And for those of you who might be hiding in a cave and you don't know who Kate Anthony is, just kidding. Kate is giggling in the background. She is the host of the Divorce Survival Guide podcast, ranked by the New York Times as one of the best divorce podcasts, you guys. She's a divorce coach and she specializes in helping women decide, should we stay or should we go? She's amazing. Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I love you and I'm so happy to be here. I love talking to you whenever we talk, whatever we talk about.
I just wish you could jump through the Zoom and be here in my office with me.
I'm planning a trip. I swear, I keep saying this, but I'm going to come out to Chicago. I really am.
All right, guys, we're all going to hold Kate to that. And then maybe for you Chicagoans and anybody, we can do a live event with Kate. So whoever's in favor, say aye. If you're listening to this in your car, on the train, while you're walking, running, just say aye and put it out there in the universe. It'll happen. So you guys, Kate is awesome. And today we're going to talk a lot about things that are relevant to so many of you. It doesn't matter if you're 24 or 84 years old. Kate, let's just jump right into this. We use the word narcissist a hell of a lot in our culture. Sometimes we use it correctly. Sometimes we use it incorrectly. I've done podcast episodes on, is this person just a jerk or are they actually a narcissist? Tell us with your experience, with everything you do, helping women get out of these toxic relationships, what is the definition of a narcissist to you? And why have you in the recent while had a change of heart on this term?
Thank you for asking it and for phrasing it that way. So, I've had a change of heart because at first we were seeing the word, there was a resurgence in the word. And I was like, everybody needs to take a breath and stop overusing this term because diagnostically it's not possible that all these people could possibly be narcissists, right? And I was like kind of a stickler about it. Like in my Facebook group, I was like, do not use the word unless there's been a diagnosis, right?
Because we can't DSM-5.
We're the DSM-5. Now, the DSM-5 really actually only talks about narcissistic personality disorder, which is very rare. However, in studying this for writing my book, which is coming out in December, little plug, which is, by the way, I just found out today is available for pre-order on Amazon. So I just saw it on there and I like almost lost my mind.
I'll put the link to that in the show notes. What's the title of the book?
It's called The D Word, Making the Ultimate Decision About Your Marriage.
Oh, I love that.
Okay. Back to narcissism. So in doing research for my book, I really sort of started to realize that actually, I don't think we are overusing the term. I think that we are finally understanding, this phenomenon. The question is, are there actually more narcissists in the world today than there used to be? Or are they just coming out of the shadows? I think both are true. I think that the way, and I will say, I'm going to use some gendered language here. I don't want everyone to be mad at me. But we certainly see this more often in men than with women, simply because of the way we raise and socialize boys and girls differently. And the expectations that we have that are different of each gender. So I think I'm also going to talk a little bit politically, so don't get mad at me. But, you know, sometime around 2016, for some reason, narcissism, there started to be more of a global conversation. And I think people were starting to recognize these signs in the people that were around them. And also, I think people became a little bit more emboldened to be more entitled and to be. And I think also the Me Too movement happened, right? There became this push against this level of entitlement and self-servitude that is sort of inherent and seen in people with narcissistic tendencies. And so I think it just became bigger. I think we started to recognize it more often. I think we started to call it out more often. And at the same time, it was starting to be more and more prevalent in our society, in our culture. And, you know, it's important to recognize that narcissism exists on a spectrum. So while the DSM may only acknowledge narcissistic personality disorder, narcissism is not all a personality disorder. So there is a spectrum, and on the one end of it, there is perfectly healthy, normal self-regard, right? And then on the far end of it is narcissistic personality disorder. And in between, you've got sort of the benign narcissist, people who are, you know, just maybe more self-referential, people who are sort of more innocently narcissistic.
Like teenagers, just saying.
Like teenage. Well, yes, right, exactly. Or people who have sort of an arrested development from a young age, whose brains never did develop, whether it's from trauma or anything else, never quite did develop beyond the self, right? And that is perfectly normal in teenagers. But when it's like your parent or something, it feels a little different. So
that was my tongue in cheek, being the mother of a 15 and a 19 year old. You can tell.
Oh, 100. I mean, you know, I've got an 18 year old in the other room. I'm right there with you. And then you've got further along the line, you have people who are more toxic narcissists, where their narcissism is really is all about trying to get their own personal needs met. Their goal in life, everything about them, is to get their personal needs met. And so they will use you and abuse you to try to get their needs met. And very often this comes from what we call the narcissistic wound, right? And a narcissistic wound is childhood trauma. And so we feel really bad for these people, right? And when you're in a relationship with them, you see them and you think, but this is just their trauma. And if I could just heal their trauma, sometimes we're in couples therapy, something like an Imago therapy, where the entire premise is I can heal my partner's wound, right? By making these behavior changes to address their, and like sort of like, you know, lean into their trauma to heal it. Well, with a narcissist, when someone is that fractured, it doesn't get healed. Mm. And this is sort of the tragedy, I think, right? Is that we work so hard so a narcissist has this brokenness, this woundedness, which actually has them have very, 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 very low self-esteem, almost no self-esteem whatsoever, even though they posture in such grandiose ways.
Like
peacocks, they look like they have really high self-esteem. They walk around like they're the most important person in the world, but they actually have incredibly low self-esteem, almost non-existent. And so they attach themselves to you to gain their sense of self. So they're going to attach themselves to someone who's really awesome and want to sort of almost like absorb your awesomeness to make them feel better. And so in the beginning, you're everything. You are the most amazing person in the world because you're going to heal them. And then over time, when you don't, because you can't, because that's not your job, and because that's not how it works, we don't heal other people, they will turn on you and then you're the bad guy. You have somehow like broken the covenant, the unspoken covenant, right? And now you have done, you haven't done your part. You haven't upheld your part of the bargain. And that's where things can turn. And it's not a bargain that you bought into, right? But it's their assumption. You're going to heal me. But then you don't because you can't. And now you are persona non grata. And this is where abuse can start to kick in.
Wow.
I don't know if I, that was a very long-winded answer to all of that. But I do think that it is just more common and more prevalent than we ever really thought. And I do think it's a cultural systemic issue.
As and that there's a spectrum of it from
That's right. Normal, healthy
to DSM-5 diagnosable, but that most people may not walk around with a DSM-5 diagnosis because narcissists don't think that there's anything wrong with them. So they're not going to sit in front of a therapist and say, hey, narcissist, because a narcissist thinks you're the narcissist.
You're the problem. You're the narcissist. You're the abuser. You're the problem. You didn't heal me. You didn't do. And this is why being in a narcissist, being in a relationship with a narcissist, it's like it's always a moving target, right? If you would just do X, then I would feel better. If you would just do Y, then our relationship would be fine. So you shoot for X and you didn't quite get it right. So then you start to shoot for Y and that's not it either. And it's because none of it is going to be the thing because they're not in a relationship. Dr. Emma Katz, who's an amazing academic on the subject of coercive control. And in all of her writings, she puts the word relationship in quotes. Because you're not actually in a relationship with someone. And a being in a relationship with a narcissist is essentially the same as being in a relationship with an abuser. Narcissists are abusive, not because they're intending to be abusive most of the time. They're not sociopaths. Or psychopaths, but they really are trying to get needs met that are not yours to meet. But being in a relationship with one is actually abusive, right? It is an abusive relationship.
Because you can't heal somebody else. And if somebody thinks you can, it's just friction.
That's right.
Just friction. And ultimately they're pointing the mirror outward saying
That's right.
You aren't doing enough. You're not giving enough. You're not changing enough. You're not listening to me enough. You're not enough, enough, enough. And instead the mirror needs to come back and point at their own belly buttons and their own faces and say, hey, the problem is right here. Only you can heal you. Nobody else can heal you, but there's no ability to introspect because a narcissist, as you said, is wounded with very low self-esteem. And so the thought of doing any introspection is frightening because they won't like what they see.
That's right. And this can lead to, there's something called a narcissistic collapse, which is when all of the like outward deflection somehow doesn't work. It backfires and the mirror is suddenly turned on them and they suddenly are forced to see it all. And it is, I have seen it happen and it can be one of the most profound and frightening things to occur because they're talk about a fracture, right? It is a collapse. It is a psychological collapse. It's a calamity. And it's also like, okay, now you're going to get somewhere. If you then take this to the right places, maybe we can get somewhere. I don't think they're never not a narcissist, right?
Okay. I was going to say, can they change when they have that?
I think they can change.
That cataclysmic inflection point where all of it collapses and maybe instead of shooting the air, like it's this person and this person and this person and this person in that flash of epiphany, maybe they could say, oh my God, the common denominator in all of these messes is me, myself, and I.
Right.
Now, yeah. Can that happen to a narcissist? So, and then if so, can they change? Like, can it be permanent?
Yeah. So, now I am not a clinician. I do know, I think that there's, I think people are divided on this, to be honest. I know I've spoken with clinicians who are like, nope. And then I've spoken to other clinicians who are like, yeah, you know, it is possible, but it would take years and years and years of intense therapy with somebody who actually knows how to manage this. But also what I tend to believe, and again, I'm not a clinician on this. What I tend to believe is that they can learn to change behaviors. I don't know that they can actually heal the core fracture, the narcissistic wound. I don't know that a narcissistic wound is fixable. But they can, when faced with the reality of who they are and who they have been and how much damage they have done, they can change behaviors. With a lot of support and a lot of work. And what I always have to say and caution people against is you can't manufacture that. Yeah. You can't, if you're with a narcissist and you want them to change, it's not going to be you being like, I'm going to walk out the door and then I'm going to cause a narcissistic collapse and then everything will be fine and I'll come back. Right? Like it doesn't work that way.
No.
So it needs to, like, the only way that someone has that kind of collapse is when they actually lose everything, but not as a tool, not as a tactic, not as a, I'm going, see, I'm leaving.
You know? Right. It's like the earthquake and the tsunami happens.
Absolutely.
And they're left in the rubble.
That's right. That's right. They have to be left in the rubble. They have to. And that's the only way that it can happen. And so, you know, I think, like I said, I think they can change behaviors. I don't know that they can completely change. And if they do, then it can be, it would have to be many, many years of hard work.
Right.
It's tragic, you know. And by the way, you know, one of the other reasons, like you said, like the diagnosis level or the rate of diagnosis for people with narcissistic personality disorder is really low because they don't think there's anything wrong with them. It's you. You're the problem.
Right.
And many of the ones that are diagnosed because they go into treatment for something else, whether it's an addiction disorder, you know, substance use disorder, something else. And then that diagnosis comes out as part of that treatment plan. So, you know, I think it's vastly underdiagnosed, to be honest. But again, we just have no way of specifically knowing.
Yeah. And, you know, on a side note, guys, as you're listening to this, I will tell you that when you've been in a relationship with a narcissistic abuser, and maybe you have family of origin stuff that also links to that, and you have those wounds. I had a client in our practice at Smart Dating Academy that came in and, you know, wrote a throwaway line in one of the questionnaires that we send. And she says, my therapist thinks I might have borderline personality disorder. And my team flagged that, and I went to one of my key resources, Dr. Michelle Roberts, who does EMDR and trauma therapy for women that have been exposed to narcissistic abuse.
Yes.
And she said to me, oh, Bella, I'm so glad you came to me about this, because women that have been abused by narcissists can often present to untrained therapists as if they have borderline personality disorder. This is a woman, she has what's called CPTSD, complex PTSD, and they present as borderline.
Yeah.
I literally, like, my heart broke open in 100 different places because I talked to this girl. I'm like, this is not borderline personality disorder. This girl has been
trauma
around. It's trauma. And that's why I didn't trust what her therapist said. And I sent her to a different one, and, you know, she's doing way better. But it's really interesting what the effect. So I say this, that if you're listening to this and you feel like you've been spun around by somebody and you're getting strange diagnoses, just know you may not yet have seen the right person. Call Kate, call me. We'll help you walk through that. But it's, this stuff is really complicated. And that's, you right, need somebody who can really peel back the layers of the onion to help you probably say, it's probably not you. It's right, what happened to you.
That's right. That's right. Most victims of abuse feel like they're crazy. They are often told that they're crazy, and they might often behave in ways that appear crazy or unhinged or whatever. And really it is, they call it reactive abuse. I don't like that term. I think it's self-defense. It's not abuse at all. It is when you are being, and this is the true definition of gaslighting. Gaslighting is not lying. Gaslighting is deliberately lying or denying another person's reality, so much so that they start to lose touch with their own sense of reality. They start to doubt their own reality. And at a certain point, they start to actually become a little bit unhinged. Because if I am constantly being told, "Kate, the sky is green. The sky is green. Oh my God, what is your problem? You see that as blue? You're crazy. That's green." Right? You start to think, oh my God, I'm fucking crazy. Now everything I look at, I don't know what color it is. There's something wrong with me.
Am I colorblind?
I must be colorblind, right? So it's, I'm the problem. No, the problem is the person who is telling you that your reality is wrong and distorted. But, you know, in extreme cases, you start to doubt your own reality. And then in more extreme cases, you can actually lose touch with reality. And so that's, I think, what happens when someone presents as perhaps having borderline personality disorder. It's like, no, you've probably been gaslit for so long that you're like coming a little bit unhinged, but that's trauma.
Oh, unbelievable. You know, since we're talking about these terms, tell us quickly the difference, because people throw these around. Is there a difference between a narcissist, an abuser, and a sociopath? And I mean, at the end of the day, people throw these terms around. I guess, does it really even matter?
So it's a great question. It only matters if you're looking to clarify your own experience. I often have people being like, oh, but is he a narcissist? Like looking for the diagnosis or the term that they can sort of overlay so that they can better convince the other person to change. Like, oh, but honey, look, you're a narcissist. So you should go to therapy and not be a narcissist, right? And that's, you know, or, oh my God. And this is the most common one, I think, is what you're doing is abuse. This is abuse. Surely, if he knew he was abusing me, he would stop, because he doesn't want to be abusing me. And so if it's to bring to the other person in an attempt to affect change in the other person, it doesn't matter. If it is so that you can clarify your experience and say, oh, I get it. Oh, he's a narcissist. Oh, I see. Or like, oh, this is actually sociopathic. Okay, so that I don't feel crazy anymore, then it's very useful. So it's only useful for your own edification.
And what is a sociopath?
So a sociopath is a person who sort of can present like a narcissist, except they actually have very high self-esteem. So narcissists tend to be created by, you know, something happens in childhood trauma, there's a fracture. Sociopaths tend to be born. They have no empathy. Narcissists also do not display empathy. Sociopaths, and by the way, there's only one diagnosis, which is antisocial personality disorder. And that sort of encompasses what we call sociopaths and psychopaths. And there's very little consistency about what the difference actually is between a sociopath or a psychopath. You talk to different people or listen to different podcasts, you'll hear lots of different explanations of the differences. But according to the DSM-5, there's only one diagnosis, which is antisocial personality disorder. And these people, not only do they not have empathy, but on brain scans, when shown the pain of another person, with a narcissist, the empathy centers tend not to light up in the brain. But with a sociopath or psychopath, not only do the empathy centers not light up, the pleasure centers do.
Oh God. It's like, yeah. Oh, here's some dopamine.
Here's some dopamine. Someone's in pain. They actually get off on it. So they're gregarious. They're very grandiose. But they enjoy other people's pain. You know, you and I love a true crime show, but you know, with the Long Island serial killer, you know, by all accounts, this man was awful. I mean, first of all, like, has there ever been a serial killer where everyone was like, yep, totally knew he was a serial killer? And they did. People, like all of his neighbors, were like, yep, makes sense. That tracks. Because he was grandiose at work. He was grandiose. He broke all the rules. He didn't care. Nothing applied to him. And so I think he's the classic, a very sort of stark example of somebody with antisocial personality disorder. And, you know, to the extreme, not only do they like get off on people's pain, but they will cause it to satisfy that in themselves. And in serial killers, that's, you know, physically. And, you know, for other people, it's just psychological torture. So that's the sociopath. And then an abuser. So, Lundy Bancroft has a whole thing in his amazing book, Why Does He Do That? Where he talks about, you know, because narcissists are sort of created by a fracture, usually from a primary caregiver. So it's usually a mother, right? There's some kind of wounding in childhood, but with the childhood initial attachment. He's like, then we get to blame women. And then it's like, oh, it's women's fault all over again. And when you're talking about an abuser, you're talking about somebody who has sort of been conditioned by society at large, where you've got a culture that doesn't foster men and boys' connection to the empathy centers in their own lives, in themselves. You know, if you cry at a movie and you show empathy in a movie as a young kid, many boys are taught like, yeah, man up, you know, you're a pussy.
Don't be, right? Yeah.
The worst thing you could be is like a girl or gay. Right.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, what Lundy says is that we create abusers that are not necessarily narcissists. They might be, but we have created a culture of, in particular, men who abuse women. And I'm only using the gendered language because the statistics are very staggering. And that does not mean that women are not abusers. I know plenty who are. It doesn't mean that women are not narcissists, because they absolutely can be. It's just that the way that we socialize boys and men creates this far more frequently in men than women.
That's right. Wow. Really super fascinating. yeah. Mind blowing.
Uplifting.
Stuff.
So uplifting.
Right. And so, I mean, related to that, Kate, you know, I talk about this a lot, and even, you know, mentioned the statistic in my TEDx talk a couple of years ago that, you know, the divorce rate for first marriages is 40 to 50%. For second marriages, it's 64 to 67%. And for third marriages, it goes into the 70s. Based on your work as a divorce coach, what do you think is going on with this?
I think people are not really doing the work to figure out what happened the first time. Yeah. They blame the other person. you know, well, he was an asshole or she was, you know, whatever. Let me get a new one. I'll just get another one. And they're not doing the deeper work to, you know, as we say, as you say, right, fix their picker. They've got a broken picker. And yeah, they may pick someone who looks completely different on the outside. But like a couple years in, they're like, oh, my God, how did this happen again?
Again.
They're the same. Oh, my God, they're the same. You know, different color hair, different body type, but like, oh my God. So I think that's part of it, is that we're not doing our own healing work, to do this. I also think that, men tend to repartner more quickly than women. And men are less likely to do the therapeutic work that women do for all the same reasons I said before, right? And like, if you're a man listening to this, like, I love men. I love men so much that I want so much more for you.
You're like, raising a man.
I'm raising a man. I am. And he just turned into a man. He just turned 18. And like, I love men. I want so much more for men in our society because, you know, look, this is taking its toll on men. They're dying at alarming rates at much younger ages than women because of this stress, because of the toxicity that we breed when we don't do the, you know, like, we've got to do this work. Otherwise it festers inside of us. And we have heart attacks, right? Like, it's crazy. So I love men and I want them to do this work. But what tends to happen is that men tend to repartner more quickly than women, partly because I think they really need us, right? We do so much more of the emotional labor in the marriages and the partnerships. We do more of the domestic labor. We do so much, that, you know, we need to get replaced really quickly because that's a lot of free labor. That's a lot of free therapy and all sorts of stuff that, you know, wait, I can't function without that. Hold on. And because we have socialized men to think that therapy is, you know, for wusses or whatever else, or for people who are really screwed up, that they're repartnering more quickly than they possibly should be without really doing the introspective work.
Yeah. No, you know, our research shows, right, men fall in love harder and faster. And so much of that. And you look at, you know, sometimes women in the dating process will go, well, I really want a guy that has a really great group of friends because I have a really great group of friends. Right. And they're so astounded sometimes, even with these high functional, great men, that a lot of men don't have vast networks of friends, right? And so men put so much into their romantic partnerships, right? We become everything to them, including, you know, your wife, your intimate partner, your emotional support, your therapist. And when that's removed, they're sort of left holding the bag. And right, to some extent, it's easier to date and fall in love than it is to make other guy friends.
Right. And it puts so much, then it puts, you know, all that was, you know, I have an amazing network of friends, as most women I know do, and they provide lots of different things for me. I've got my friends that I like really talk to and like have my emotional connection with. I've got friends that I go out with and laugh my ass off with. I've got friends, right? And they kind of cover the spectrum. But when someone comes into a relationship and they don't have all of those things, then like, I'm everything. I have to cover all of that. And it can be intoxicating at first, right? You're like, you know, to feel like you're somebody's everything. But over time, the burden of that is too much to bear. And it's not healthy. And then when you exhaust someone and they really can't take it anymore and they leave, you need to replace that really quickly, right?
Right. And I think so, you know, for women listening to what we're saying, it's not uncommon when you say, I want to meet all your friends. It's like, well, maybe they have one or two, and maybe they live out of state and these are college buddies. It's not strange. It's not necessarily a red flag. It just sort of is what it is. So you just want to be sure that you are giving just what you want to give in the relationship and you feel healthy, you shouldn't start to feel suffocated or that you are every single thing when you don't want to be. You might want to be, and that's fine, right? Because then it's a great partnership. But if it doesn't feel like that, and those are things that are surmountable, you might just need your own space to hang out with your friends, right? And if he's cool with that, that's fine. But it's the most important thing you need to do is use your voice and don't be afraid to use your voice. If you are afraid to use your voice in a new relationship, it's not a relationship.
That's right. That's exactly, that is like your first red flag, right? I don't feel like I can say what I need to say, you know, absolutely.
Right.
And, you know, I know men who have, you know, do have like one or two really good friends and like, that may be all they need. And that's great. Right. Like at least they have someone that they are actually intimate with. And I think for men, it's usually a much smaller group because, again, the way we socialize men is that it's not really that safe for men to be that vulnerable with each other.
That's right. And a little side note on this as a dating coach.
Yeah.
A lot of times women are like, why hasn't he been out of the country? Or why don't we do all these things? Because women tend to do things more independently, right? If I want to go to Italy and I don't have a romantic partner, well, hell, I'm going to go on my own, or I'm going to get some friends, or I'm going to join a tour group, or I'm going to take a trip alone, right? And a lot of guys are waiting for a woman to do that with them.
I'm more like them.
Oh, okay.
I'm way better at partnered stuff than single. I'm like, oh, I could just go to Italy by myself. That doesn't sound fun. I want a partner for that.
Well, and this, to your point, and this is where I tell women, go easy on these guys. Like if they haven't been out of the country yet, it's okay. It doesn't mean that this person is too parochial and, you know, just isn't going to share your worldview. That doesn't matter. Like don't make quick snap judgments on things like that. And I'm glad that you're like, well, I'm waiting to do that with the partner too. So ladies, listen to this, right? It's not necessarily a red flag that the dude's only been to Wisconsin, Iowa, and Kansas. Okay, whatever. You know what? But with the right partner, with the right lid to his pot, he might be willing to go to Maine or Washington or Japan, right? It's who cares? So it takes all kinds.
It does. And if there are any guys out there who are between the ages of 50 and 60 who are looking for a travel partner, you just let me know.
Right. Because Kate's waiting too.
She's waiting.
To travel. And let me ask you, with your clients, you know, you're bringing them through the divorce process. Do you have any thoughts on dating after divorce? We all know I have a lot of thoughts on dating after divorce, but I have so many,
but I think we're very much aligned in this. I think, you know, when you're going through a divorce, first of all, you have to check the laws in your state. There are some states that are very backwards and shockingly misogynistic. And so even if you are separated, you can be... it can be considered adultery to date before you're fully divorced. I think that's absolute BS. I think start dating whenever you want, but please just date. Learn how to date from Bella Gandhi. Please do not jump into a relationship with the first person you meet who you think is amazing. As Bella always says, anyone can be amazing for 2 hours at a time, right? We have to go through an entire season with people, dating multiple people, getting to know. Dating after divorce is one of the most profound ways to get to know yourself again. I had so much fun dating after my divorce. I learned that turns out, I actually am a sexual being, despite the fact that my ex-husband consistently told me that I was not a sexual being. Turns out I was a very sexual being. I learned that.
Just not with him.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. And, you know, I learned, you know, I remember being dating and being like, well, like I was so worried about whether he liked me and he liked me or he liked me. And my therapist was like, do you like him? And I was like, huh? And then I was like, suddenly had this like zoomed out objective view. And I was like, actually, no. And she's like, okay, learn to take your own temperature. This is a process of you learning to take your own temperature. And so if you can keep the focus on yourself, if you can go on multiple dates and learn things about you, not just about them as you're going through the process, like, actually, I don't think I do like a guy who does this, or maybe that's really weird. I felt really turned off by that. I wonder what that's about. What was right? Because if your focus is always on like getting him to like me and finding your next match, and your next big relationship, you're going to miss a lot of shit.
Make bad decisions.
Exactly.
You're going to become what my kids call a pick me girl or a pick me boy, right? And that's a big Gen Z TikTok, right? It's like me, please like me, a pick me girl. I'm like,
yeah, what? That was me.
At first I was like, a pig me? They're like, no.
Pick me.
Pick me. Oh my God, she's such a pick me. Stop being such a pick me, my son will say to my daughter, right? Like, oh, I don't know. This doesn't look good on me. No one likes me. He's like, oh, you're so pick me.
Oh my God, that's so great. I've never heard that before. And it's so true. That was me. I was a pick me girl. I wrote a Facebook post years ago about actually it's called Pick Me. Like it was all about how that's, that's how I was socialized. It's how I was raised. Listen, this is also how girls are socialized and raised, right? We wait for boys to ask us to dance at the school dance. We wait for boys to ask us on dates. We wait for boys to ask us to the prom. We wait for men to ask us to, you know, on dates. Wait for men to ask us to marry them. Like we're socialized to be pick me girls. And our work is to get out of that. And dating after divorce is a really great opportunity for that.
No, it's funny that you say that. I have a client named Lila who was on my podcast who literally told her love story. She's now married, happily married, blended family. She was a single mom, married a single dad, completely unexpected. She's African-American. She married someone who was an immigrant from Spain, like crazily awesome story. And she said, you know, to hell with it. We're climbing Kilimanjaro together. And they're super athletic and like that couple and gorgeous. And she called me. She's like, I went to REI and I bought one of those like summit rings. I'm like, what's a summit ring? I'm not a mountain climber. Like you have a little memorial ring when you get to the summit of Kilimanjaro. Cute. She's like, so I bought two because I'm going to ask Donnie to marry me when we get to the top of Kilimanjaro. So they get to the summit. They come back down. They're having dinner with their whole group. And this woman, talk about the cojones here, asked him to marry her in front of their whole summit group.
Oh my God.
They had not talked about marriage. Isn't that hilarious?
I love her.
They're now married. Right. Yeah. So you don't have to wait.
You don't have to wait
to be picked.
No.
Right. You've got the steering wheel of your own life and you've got the steering wheel for your own mindset. You can be in love or you can be in fear. You've got the steering wheel of should you stay or should you go? You've got the steering wheel of how do I date after divorce? You've got the steering wheel to decide, do I need help to not end up in those shitty divorce statistics, right? Everything you need, ladies and gentlemen, is right inside of you already. You just have to remember that. So, Kate, thank you so much for joining us today. You are a gem. And not a narcissist, not a sociopath, not an abuser, a beautiful, lovely, sparkly soul that I'm proud to call my friend. So thank you for dropping your gems on us.
I love you. Thank you for having me, Bella. It is always such a pleasure to talk to you.
And I'm going to have Kate send me a link to your book so we can pre-order it. So all of you support the sweet Kate with the pre-order on her book because she is magic, and make sure you also listen to her podcast. And Kate, we will definitely have you back. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you, honey. Anytime.
Smart daters, if this made you really think about, am I ready to take this plunge? Have I been with narcissists? Do I need intervention? This is not a pattern that solves itself easily. Reach out, send us an email, do a consultation with us. We're here. Okay. The power is in your hands. Make the decisions that are right for you and stand in that power. With that, we will see you next week.
Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.